The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler and the Washington Post. And before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that we might feature in the articles we'll read. They are simply selected for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to start with our ongoing series, 50 States Road Trips, picking up with our 31st stop, New Jersey, featuring routes that are best for history. This article is from the April-May 2018 issue of the National Geographic Traveler and written by Mary Ellen Kennedy Duckett. Jersey Shore Lighthouse Tour, Sandy Hook to Cape May Point. Follow the light. Houses, that is, for a historic look at New Jersey's 130-mile shore. Start the 8-lighthouse route at Sandy Hook, the shore's northernmost lighthouse and the nation's oldest operating since 1764. And on a high note at Cape May Lighthouse, where climbing up 199 steps earns you sweeping ocean and Delaware Bay views. Now on to 32, New Mexico. New Mexico's state trail of the ancient scenic byway, Chaco Canyon to Farmington. Not to be confused with the national byway of the same name, this nearly 600-mile trail celebrates the state's Native American heritage as it weaves through Navajo Nation and Zuni land. Short on time, we'll go directly to Chaco Culture National State Park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that dates its earliest occupation to 850 A.D. Number 33 is Rhode Island, East Narragansett Bay, East Providence to Newport. Ease into historic Newport from points north on Route 114, a more local and scenic alternative to I-95, and on the 30-mile drive, visit Bristol's Colt State Park to walk the Bayside Trails and experience 18th-century farm life at Cogshill Farm Museum. In Middleton, try the Portuguese fish chowder at Anthony Seafood and tour Newport Vineyards Winery. Number 34 is Texas. Texas Pecos Heritage Trail Region. Channel the spirit of the Wild West on a rambling 1,356-mile loop around West Texas. The trek begins in Midland and follows the 1968 Texas Pecos Trail south to the U.S.-Mexico border. Explore cowboy, military, and Native American heritage at places like Seminole Canyon State Park and historic site, home to more than 200 pictograph locations. Well, next we're going to switch to state routes that know how to be friendly, family friendly, that is. And we're going to start in Arizona, the 35th stop of our 50 states road trip. Historic Route 66, you've heard of that one, I'm sure, and beyond. Although I-40 replaced much of the original Mother Road, the I-170-mile Top Rock to Ash Fork stretch is intact. Alternate between I-40 and Route 66 for a retro road trip. Spend the night at Wigwam Village No. 6 Hotel in Holbrook, and then there's a bonus. Hike the Wave, featured on our cover, near the Utah border. Plan ahead, as only 20 people per day can visit. That's right, just a limit of 20 people per day. And the cover photo of the wave does show the swirling rock formations that look like ocean waves caught in a freeze frame. Now, except these waves are rocks flowing in earth tones. Well, now on to number 36, Connecticut, the Connecticut Art Trail. A $25 art passport gets you into more than 20 museums, galleries, and historic sites such as New Haven's Yale Center for British Art and Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University. Before you go, register for a workshop at Norwalk's Center for Contemporary Printmaking. 37 is Florida, Forgotten Coast, St. Mark's to Mexico Beach, U.S. 98. Blissfully off the tourist path, the roughly 100-mile Forgotten Gulf Coast is laid back and altogether memorable. Fresh shucked local oysters make it onto the menu at Apalachicola's Hole in the Wall. A St. Joseph's and Pensacola State Park beaches remain unspoiled. For different perspective, climb the 100-step Cape St. George Lighthouse. And then we go to Indiana, which is number 38 on our list. Family Fun Loop, Indianapolis, Columbus, Bloomington, Indianapolis. The Hoosier State's heart ticks all the right family vacation boxes. Three children's museums, summer horseback riding at Brown Country State Park, and the five-scoop shareable Big Z Sundays at Columbus Zaccaro's Ice Cream Parlor and Museum. Start and end the 133-mile loop at downtown Indy's White River State Park, home to the Indianapolis Zoo. And number 39, Nebraska, Bridges to Buttes Byway, Harrison to Valentine, U.S. 20. If the name of this 197-mile byway doesn't entice the kids, the Big Fun Nebraska Adventures will. Real and replica fossils and skeletons of 20-million-year-old mammals surface at Harrison's Agate Fossil Beds National Monument. Roam the otherworldly rock formations at Toadstool Geologic Park north of Crawford. Then spot bison, deer, elk, and prairie dogs at Fort Niobrara National Wildlife Refuge in Valentine. And number 40 for today, our final stop for this episode, is Nevada, and it's the UFO stopover loop. Las Vegas, Alamo, Tonopah, and Pahrump. Go full X-Files with Travel Nevada's new tongue-in-cheek itinerary for intergalactic visitors. All life forms are welcome to make the 487-mile or 8.284E-11 light-year trip, which includes driving Lincoln County's extraterrestrial highway north of Area 51, the off-limits military base at the center of many UFO conspiracies, and hiking the Mars-like landscape at Valley of Fire State Park in Overton. Well, we'll be checking out the last 10 routes of our 50 states road trip in a future episode of Armchair Traveler. But right now, we're going to switch continents as we go Under African Skies, written by George W. Stone, editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler. His article is found in the magazine's April-May 2018 issue, and it begins with a photo of several people sitting on director's chairs in water watching the sunset. And the caption states, "A day on foot in South Luangwa National Park ends with sundowners in the Kapamba River and hippos in the distance." And as the subtitle reads, "A wild adventure, a spectacular sense of place, and a shocking discovery on a walking safari in Zambia's South Luangwa National Park." Boy, does this sound like an interesting trip. Let's go. Zambia is no country for dawdling men, as the aptly named go-away bird, Southern Africa's pompadour-crested alarm clock from hell, is quick to let me know. "Quaw! Quaw! Quaw!" it calls, pecking away at my afternoon slumber. "Quaw! What kind of simpleton sleeps on a safari? Quaw! Wake up!" The midday sun scorches in dry season, but I emerge from my mosquito netting to scowl at the bird perched on a branch above my tent. Across the river, I see three elephants foraging near the bank. Following their matriarch, they trundle along in descending order of height, munching on tufts of grass, their backs covered in a protective layer of dirt. Even at a distance, they appear large. Even in their lumbering realness, they seem imagined. Being on safari is a dream, I think, and for a few moments, I'm not sure I'm awake. The Luangwa River loops and meanders for some 500 miles in eastern Zambia, forming pools that churn with crocs and oxbow lakes that support wildlife in such abundance that for safari goers, the nearly 3,500-square-mile woodland savanna of South Luangwa National Park is a connoisseur's secret, an animal lover's destination. I'm staying at Zangilia, one of six camps near Luangwa River managed by the Bush Camp Company, a National Geographic unique lodge of the world. I have come to walk with the animals to learn about the wild world from the dirt up instead of the Land Rover down. Strange though it may seem, the idea of walking safari was not a natural evolution but introduced practice pioneered half a century ago by game rangers and conservationists who sought to inspire a new ethic of engagement with the environment. On a walking safari, a human is briefly compelled to become an animal again, to relinquish dominance and sample vulnerability. Everything is bigger when you're on the ground. I'm at the confluence of the Luangwa and Kapamba rivers, and grasses that look like fronds from afar turn out to be shoulder-high thorn walls. I'm following guide Kelvin Zulu on an afternoon walk beside the river. We're trailed by Zambia Wildlife Authority scout Isaiah Mbula. We investigate a towering termite mound and spot a lion's paw print in the sand, the circumference of a cabbage. Kelvin's reading the dirt when a scampering water buck rustles the bushes. I shiver and get goosebumps. Suddenly, I feel naked standing on the soil, exposed in my foolish attempts to achieve invisibility by wearing green clothing. The survival tools I've packed, sunblock, hand sanitizer, and a cell phone, there is no reception here, reveal me to be a creature of the material world, a person whose inclinations are to subdue, not embrace, the wild. And yet here I am, listening, observing, walking, with each step returning to the land, sensing the space around me, and sending warthogs dashing into the underbrush. "Fresh leopard prints," says Kelvin, who has been describing the particulars of paws. "Hyena prints are splayed and meaty. African wild dog prints are squarish and tidy. Baboon prints look like a small human hand with an extra palm. Safaris are ritualized meanderings, circular quest in which a question leads to an answer, which leads to another question, and so on. Every detail, from a broken branch to a bird call, is part of a larger story that makes sense when told the right way. That's what the guides do. They collect the clues, unravel the mysteries, and weave the narrative. The best guides elucidate. They don't romanticize. The beauty of discovering the wild is not that its mysteries are inexplicable. It's that its truths are comprehensible. On safari, curiosity is rewarded. Kelvin plucks a tiny waxy tube from the trunk of a mopane tree. It's a portal into a hive of the minuscule stingless bee. "You can have honey without the sting," he says, "just not much honey." Now 33, Kelvin has been fixated on wildlife since he was a child and was nearly trampled to death by an elephant when he was collecting water at the river. While growing up in Mfue, the village at the park's gate, he became chairman of his school's conservation club and a defender of wildlife, even when elephants tramped and devoured valuable crops. Back in the truck, returning to camp, we spot a leopard in a tree, chomping on a baboon. We drive close and snap pictures. South Luangwa is one of the world's top spots for viewing leopards, and this one knows it. He's unbothered and proud and lazy enough to be falling asleep before our eyes. As sunset nears, the land exhales with the cough of water buffalo, ticking toads, and an elephant's trumpet in the distance. It's as if all the earth is slowly venting heat. We return to camp on the trail of a honey badger, and I see the marsh below is filled with grazing impalas. It occurs to me that not every animal that sees tonight's moon will see tomorrow's sun. That night, a lion walked past my tent. I was awoken by a deep vibrato lament rolling down the river. As the call increased in volume, it was accompanied by the crunch of dry leaves. The lion approached my tent and moaned on the opposite side of a gauzy screen 10 feet from my head. The call grew fainter as the beast crept away along the riverbank, a shadow in the moonlight. It's called a carnivorous Doppler effect. I fell asleep despite the fear of becoming a lion's midnight snack. A pink sun rises, and I find Kelvin beside a campfire as the Kampamba River reemerges from its dark night. I ask about the lion, who turns out to have a colorful history. Cassius and his partner Brutus were dominant males who banded together to control their territory and increase and protect their prides. The lions had been named by the human population and respected for their control of a vast area. But then one day, Brutus disappeared, the coalition frayed, and Cassius walked alone. When Brutus reappeared months later, he'd lost his mane. He was gaunt, and his hip seemed to be dislocated. The solitary lions turned to smaller game, even scavenging like hyenas. This downfall set the stage for a new pair of lions to steal their territory, a challenge now underway. When Cassius walked past my tent at night, he was calling out for Brutus, perhaps, or to let the usurpers know that he would not go down without a fight. On our game drive, malachite kingfishers dive into the water, and lilac-breasted rollers and white-fronted bee-eaters dart near the dun-colored bank. We hop out of the truck near a pod of grunting hippos, filing into the river, and meet a team of ecologists working with the Zambia Wildlife Authority to monitor the park. I'm reminded that a safari is not just a sensory experience, but a social experience as well. To study animals on safari is to discover their interactions within their species, beyond their species, within their environment, and in relation to all the factors that influence their lives, including human communities living on the perimeter of the parkland. Big Rich Boutique is the name of a shop in Mfue. On a drive through town, we see tables piled high with potatoes and mobile phone recharging stands and the words, "God Gives," on the wall of Project Luanga, a community development organization. Kelvin shows me a school where classrooms have been funded by guests of the Bush Camp Company. On a desk, I find a notebook a student left behind. I read this curious set of sentences written in blue ink, translated from a Bantu language to English. How good and pleasant it is for people to live happily together. The day of judgment will surely come without fail, and finally, only mad people can demand total freedom. Commitments to conservation and community are essential to the mission of the Bush Camp Company, and I learned about a lunch program that feeds 2,500 students each day. I pumped clean water from one of 17 Bush Camp-sponsored boreholes drilled last year, which eliminate the need for locals to make risky runs to croc-infested rivers. About 15 years ago, there were no roads here, explained Andy Hogg, a native Zambian who founded the company. But our business is part of a larger ecosystem that must support the human population. On my last morning, the sun radiated an angry orange over the Kampamba River. We trailed a pack of African wild dogs crossing the water and found a lioness tearing into a zebra while her two cubs waited their turn and hyenas lurked in the grass. In the distance, a kettle of vultures circled in the sky. Kelvin steered the truck over a dry lagoon mottled with hippo prints to get closer. The vultures swooped down to nip and peck at a massive carcass. The air was rank and moist. We studied the mound. We puzzled, and then we realized. Of all safari sightings, we had tracked down the worst, a poached elephant, eviscerated, butchered of its meat, trunk removed, tusk torn out, exposed ribcage buzzing with insects. Near the elephant was an ashy campfire, still warm from the night before, along with a rifle-cleaning brush and a heavy wood stake intended for transporting flesh. There was no ivory in sight. Kelvin estimated that the elephant would have been about 40 years old. Its tusk would be worth about $200 when introduced to the illegal market. Ivory increases in value through subsequent exchange. The elephant's meat would be worth more than its ivory at the local level. It would have taken 10 men to carry the meat and tusk. Safari is about death as well as life. Animals sometimes eat each other to survive. This is the circle of life. But what I saw that day isn't a necessary part of that pattern, and it will be a long time before I digest it. Elephant populations in South Luanga National Park are possibly increasing according to the Great Elephant Census Research Project. Poaching is uncommon here, but in other parts of Zambia, including along the border with Angola and Namibia, populations are declining, an echo of the declared extinction of Zambia's rhinos in 1993. The loss of wildlife threatens communities supported by the safari industry. But living with animals isn't a walk in the park. They can devour crops and trample villages. I recalled an earlier conversation I had with Kelvin. We discussed the economy of elephants, comparing their value as tourist attractions, as hunters' trophies, and as contraband. For Kelvin, the question of how to assess the value of an elephant is related to what will improve the lives of many people in Mfue. Through tourism, a living elephant benefits more people over its lifetime, he said. But it's not so easy when people are depending on you to provide for them. A bush camp tradition awaits sundowners at the river. Not beside the river or near the river, but in the river. Chairs are lined atop a sandbar in the middle of the Kampamba. A card table serves as a makeshift bar, and a popcorn explodes from a pan on the fire. To the crocs, we probably look like Kardashians, noisy, possibly tasty, but not worth the effort. Back at camp, we discover an unexpected visitor. Brutus has returned, limping along the bank. His mane is growing back, and his proximity suggests that he's either wise or desperate. So we keep our distance. That night, Brutus sleeps in the camp. Being on safari is a dream, I think. And I fall asleep, too. Wow, what a story, huh? There you go, Zambia's South Luanga National Park. Well, from a walking safari in Africa, we're going to fly to the western USA for our next adventure, Classic Rock, exploring the spectacular landscape of South Central Utah. Dina Mischev's article appeared in the May 24th issue of the Washington Post. Like most hikes and drives in South Central Utah, Lower Muley Twist Canyon is both heavenly and hellish for someone curious about what's around the next corner, and I definitely am. It's possible to hike down the canyon in Capitol Reef National Park for 12 miles and turn at least three times as many corners. I'm in this part of Utah because it's still snowing where I live in northwest Wyoming, and in late March the temperatures are in the 60s, maybe even the 70s. I'm already somewhat familiar with the area, but there are plenty of hikes and back road drives I haven't yet done. Also, one of my favorite restaurants, Hell's Backbone Grill, in its 19th season, is here. Doing pre-trip online reconnaissance, the full 12-mile Lower Muley Twist endeavor piques my curiosity. I don't have the physical fitness to do it in a single day, though. Still, I don't trust that this is reason enough to make me turn around, so I make a 6:15 p.m. dinner reservation at the farm-to-table restaurant in the traditional Mormon town of Boulder, population about 250. Hell's Backbone Grill serves Four Corners cuisine, which draws from Mormon pioneer recipes, Puebloan cultural dishes, and cowboy fare and whatever grows on the farm at 7,000 feet in elevation. I figure if I hike about 2 miles down the canyon from the rail trailhead on the Burr's Trail scenic backway and then retrace my route, I'll have just enough time to drive back to Boulder, check in at the Boulder Mountain Lodge, which is the only lodging downtown, and shower before dinner. Solo surprises. Mine is the only car in the small trailhead parking lot. The trail immediately descends about 40 feet through Utah juniper trees and onto the canyon floor, which is a dry creek bed. I'm quickly dwarfed by undulating red sandstone formations. The canyon lives up to its name. Every twist reveals another twist, and every corner reveals a surprise. One corner delivers a section of narrows where the canyon walls suddenly come together, and the sandy path down the middle shrinks to a width of 20 feet. Coming around the next corner, there is a weeping wall where seeping minerals make the otherwise vermilion 500-foot-tall sandstone wall look like it is crying soot-black tears. And then comes a corner that is itself a corner, an undercut 300-foot-long 90-degree bend in the canyon that, when Lower Muley Creek floods, is obviously the scene of much violence. The bottom 15 feet of the sandstone here bears the scars of all manner of injury. There are holes, dents, dings, scratches, and scrapes. Before I know it, I am 1 mile past my planned turnaround distance and have a blister on my left foot, but I'm not yet ready to turn around. After all, Hell's Backbone Grill and pretty much everywhere for several hundred miles in every direction doesn't care if I shower before dinner. I get around two more corners before I realize I'll miss my meal if I don't turn around and run back to the car. But the extra corners are worth it. The last opens into a blocky rock garden at the base of Zion-like sheer cliffs that appear to be illuminated from within. I first think that my polarized sunglasses are playing tricks on me. When I take them off, the cliffs have every bit as much glow. Driving back to Boulder on the Burr Trail Scenic Backway, a 66-mile paved and dirt road between Boulder and Bullfrog Marina on the northwest shore of Lake Powell in the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, it kills me that I don't have time to stop and take photos. Near the start of the drive, I see Peekaboo Arch to the west. Next comes a high desert forest of pinyons and Utah junipers, even though some of the juniper trees may be almost 100 years old. I don't think any more are than 20 feet tall. From about AD 400 to 1200, the ancestral Puebloans who lived in this area made use of both these species as food. I open both front windows so that the junipers can infuse the inside of my car with their sweetly resinous smell, similar to that of cedars. I exit Capitol Reef National Park and enter Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and its 1 million, formerly 1.9 million, but President Trump reduced its size last December, tangled acres of sinuous slot canyons, mesas, and cliffs. Despite the monument covering some of the country's harshest landscape upon entering it, the Burr Trail goes from dirt and gravel to pavement, albeit without the amenities found on most roads such as center lines or shoulders. Not taking photos in Long Canyon, a 7-mile-long one with sheer golden and dark red sandstone walls that stretch several hundred feet high, takes more self-discipline than turning around in Lower Muley Twist Canyon did. But driving past the white sandstone sand dunes at 6 p.m., which I know are 6 miles from the lodge and restaurant, I allow myself a brief photo stop. The clouds, like overstuffed down pillows, split the evening sun into biblical beams. You might think that no restaurant could be worth a popped blister in speeding through the Burr Trail's landscape. You'd be wrong. I talk myself into missing the surprises around future Lower Muley Twist Corners because the constantly changing menu at Hell's Backbone Grill is a continued good surprise. I've eaten there 4 times before. Monumental eating. When President Bill Clinton established the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in 1996, it was big news, but it wasn't until the grill opened in 2000 that the monument and boulder came onto my radar. This evening, I am driving alone. Choosing is more excruciating than usual. How to pick between goat cheese fondue and a steamed artichoke served with lemon aioli made from eggs laid by Baker's Acres on chickens. A family of 5 is seated next to me and puts their entire order in before I settle on the artichoke, and that's just the appetizer. There's the spicy chipotle meatloaf entree. A few things on the menu are constant, but I instead order a New York strip steak. The beef is from a cow that grazed in Grand Staircase Escalante. Unlike national parks, national monuments, especially this one, are sometimes managed for multiple uses and not just protection of the land. It might just be my imagination, fueled by driving through the forest on the way back from the Lower Muley Twist Canyon, but when the steak arrives and I begin to eat, I taste notes of pinion and juniper. The next morning, I drive my favorite section of Highway 12, the 28-mile between Boulder and Escalante, which, with a population of about 800, is the largest city in the area. The Hogback is in this stretch, but this time the corners on the road as it descends to the Escalante and the Calf Creek Recreation Area really enthrall me. Unlike Lower Muley Twist Canyon's corners, I know that's what's around these, and still I grin, giggle, and press harder on the gas pedal as I go into each one. And by the way, Dina Mischief is a writer based in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which we've read about in previous episodes. And she has a website. It's dinamischief.com, DinaMischief.com. And you can follow her on Instagram as well as at Dina Mischief. And so there you go. Some really fascinating stuff about this gorgeous area of Utah. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed your journey today and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.